Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll tell you all about an event to celebrate the dead, Dia de los Muertos Dayton, happening next week. Also, WISO Community Voices producer Basim Blunt talks with one of the organizers of a free screening Monday of the movie More Than a Month. The movie is about ending the annual celebration of Black History Month. And later in the program, our final installment for this month of the Antioch Writers Workshop. Up first, a story in Bloomberg earlier this week found that hedge fund Magnetar has bought up a significant chunk of the rental stock in Montgomery County's Huber Heights and then requested a major reduction in those property values. That reduction, if approved, could affect the city's taxes and levies. WISO's Lewis Wallace talks to Heather Perlberg and John Gittleson about the issue.
Thanks for talking today.
Sure.
Thanks for having us.
You reported that Magnetar Capital, which is a hedge fund, bought up nearly 2,000 rentals, and 1,500 of those or so are in Huber Heights. And then the company asked the county to reassess property values downwards. Why does that matter?
It matters for a couple of reasons. One is they won't be paying as much property taxes, so the schools have already been hit hard, which depend the most on property taxes. And then it could also encourage other people to lower their property values, and you get this sort of downward spiral.
Huber Heights has a school levy on this November's ballot that's already been shot down several times, and the school district is kind of desperately going back to the voters to request new funding. How do these property assessments affect levy funding?
Right now, people in a certain area are obligated to pay a dollar amount every year. So if the assessments go down in the future, their tax rates will go up to be able to repay these obligations.
And what is Magnetar saying about this?
They say they're going to use the money that they're saving in the property taxes to reinvest in the homes they already have in the area.
And that will increase the value of the homes and create an upward spiral. So everybody would win.
The broader context here, as I understand it, is that the U.S. rental market has changed since the housing bust. What can you tell me about that change?
You've had lots of institutional investors coming in and buying up generally distressed property through foreclosure auctions, short sales, and they've amassed these huge amounts of homes that they are then turning into rental businesses.
And there's been about 8 million people nationally who lost homes to foreclosure, had to do a short sale. So now those people are renters because they can't get a mortgage on a house. So there's more demand for rentals, and then these Wall Street-backed firms are becoming the new big landlords.
So Magnetar really stands to benefit from this newly hardy rental market. But your report also suggests that the company was connected to practices that led to the housing crash in the first place. How so?
Magnetar sort of helped the banks sell these intricate, financially engineered bonds that helped fuel the housing bubble by continuing kind of risky loans to borrowers that didn't have the best credit, and then bet even bigger against those bonds that the housing market would fail.
And beyond Huber Heights, why should people care about this story?
This is the first instance that we've seen, but that doesn't mean it isn't going to happen elsewhere. There are a lot of companies like this that could come in and decide they want to buy a more concentrated collection of homes to rent instead of having them spread out and then kind of flex their muscles, which really is going to have a greater impact on communities than what is happening now.
I'm talking to Heather Perlberg and John Gittleson, reporters with Bloomberg. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Montgomery County, which includes Huber Heights, will reassess property values on all homes in 2014. You're listening to Under Construction, WISO's series on growth in the greater Dayton area. We go beneath the physical and economic markers of growth to look at the human consequences. For WISO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
This week, Governor John Kasich bypassed the Ohio legislature when the state controlling board approved federal money for a Medicaid expansion. And just a day later, a lawsuit was filed to stop it. This week, WISO News Director Emily McCord spoke with Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau to discuss what's happening next with Medicaid.
Ohio law says the state controlling board's allowed to approve expenditures outside of the state budget. So what's the legal argument from opponents of Medicaid expansion?
Well, the legal argument is that when the legislature passed its budget, its version of the budget, which took Medicaid expansion that the governor had proposed out of the budget, the legislature actually included a line in its passed budget that said that the governor could not expand Medicaid. Well, then when the governor got a hold of the budget, he used his line item veto power and struck that line out. So the legal argument with this case is that the legislature clearly had an intent to not have Medicaid expanded, and therefore the governor has violated the legislature's intent. But what's interesting here is there are six lawmakers who are named in this lawsuit who are joining the lawsuit. Four of those lawmakers voted against that budget because they found other things in the budget that they didn't like. All of these lawmakers are conservative Republicans, by the way, including Ron Magg from Lebanon. And now the question is, well, if they voted against the budget, then how can they claim that this is going against the legislature's intent because they went against the budget? So it makes for a really interesting argument.
But he vetoed it, so it wasn't technically written into law that the legislature was against this. So is that where the sticking point is here?
Well, it was in the legislature's original budget. When you see the language that the legislature passed, that line is still in there. And so these lawmakers and the suit are trying to claim that that was the legislature's intent. They meant it. They put it in there and they kept it in there. It was the governor that stripped it out. And so the governor is going beyond his authority to expand Medicaid.
And so how does the governor and supporters of Medicaid expansion stand behind that?
Well, that's what we're going to find out here soon. I mean, certainly the governor has his whole team that's very much behind his efforts to expand Medicaid. And we're waiting to hear more from the governor. He really has been very, very quiet and, in fact, absent from a lot of events here since the Medicaid expansion did pass the controlling board. So it will be interesting to hear how he defends this. I believe his defense has been that he took this issue to the federal government. The federal government gave him the authority to expand Medicaid in terms of having the money to do it. And then the controlling board just appropriated the money to the expansion request.
With this lawsuit hanging over all of this, what does it mean for the timeline of Medicaid expansion? Will it hold things up?
As of right now, the folks who are filing the lawsuit, which is a conservative group called the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law, and those six Republicans I mentioned before, they're not seeking an injunction. So as of right now, the plan is to go ahead and start enrolling people in Medicaid. I mean, certainly this passed right as it did right now because there's this deadline of January 1st. The federal government starts paying 100% of the costs for Medicaid expansion on January 1st for 3 years. And so those who support Medicaid expansion do not want to wait because then the state could lose some of that $13 billion in federal money that they say they can get over the next 7 years.
I want to play this piece of tape from Governor Kasich. He made this comment when he was in Cleveland before Medicaid expansion was approved. And this is what he had said to opponents of the measure to expand.
And we were talking about this morning. Why is it that some people don't get it? Is it because they're hard-hearted or cold-hearted, or it's probably because they don't understand the problem?
Pretty harsh words for members of his own party, and I wonder what kind of political implications this could have for the governor.
Well, the governor has been pushing this and really putting a lot of his personal capital on this since he first proposed it in February, and then, of course, the legislature stripped it out. And so he's really not let this go. And I think he got a bit frustrated. So what happens now is we have two lawmakers who were removed from the controlling board right before the vote, Representatives Ron Amstutz and Cliff Rosenberger. Cliff Rosenberger's from Southwest Ohio. And both of these gentlemen are in the running to be speaker when Bill Batchelder retires. If either one of those gentlemen become speaker, it could be very challenging for the governor, if he is reelected, to get some of his initiatives through because, well, Ron Amstutz was very clear in saying he was very disappointed in the move to take this to the controlling board and disappointed that he did not get a chance to vote no on this. So you could have, if the governor's reelected, some conflicts and clashes, which we have not seen with this governor and this legislature.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Absolutely. It's going to make for next year's campaign interesting as well, because both Governor Kasich and Ed Fitzgerald, who's the Democratic nominee, they both support Medicaid expansion. So there's one thing they agree on, but it's going to be interesting to see how they disagree on how it was done or what might happen afterwards.
I've been speaking with Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here.
No problem. Thank you for the invitation.
In the late 40s, engineers Hardy Trolander and John Benedict and chemist David Jones wanted to solve problems through what they called good science. That led them to form Yellow Springs Instruments, or YSI, in 1948. Trolander was appointed the company's first president, and along with fellow Antioch alum David Case, YSI continued its mission of using good science until the company was sold in 2011. Hardy Trolander died on Friday, October 11th, and to find out more about the man and his legacy, I spoke with Malte von Matheson, who became president of YSI in 1983 after Trolander's retirement. We began by talking about the good science that Trolander believed in.
The good science part of that, it really focuses on products and technology that improve the condition of the human race, so to speak. Products that focused on medicine, measuring the quality of water. These were enormous contributions that benefited society.
And what were some of the bigger projects or the more successful and that took off?
One of the most important projects that I remember is the collaboration with Leland Clark, who was also a graduate of Antioch College, and the two of them came up with a sensor that could measure dissolved oxygen in a liquid environment. And subsequently, especially when the U.S. EPA was given the authority or the responsibility for laying down the rules of the game relative to improving water in the natural habitat, this became the industry standard. In addition to that, Lee, Clark, and Hardy commercialized a sensor that measured sugar in whole blood without any dilution. And it was a big breakthrough in terms of the science. Well, some of the temperature sensors that Hardy licensed from Bell Labs were used in space shuttles and in the heat shields of a number of the modules that came back to Earth and survive burning up through the Earth's atmosphere.
Hardy believed in the social benefits that could come out of a business for a community. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Yes. One of the interesting things that Hardy did was establish an employee stock ownership plan, which is a trust, and he put shares of YSI stock or Yellow Springs Instrument Company stock into this trust for the benefit of the employees. So he was willing to share the wealth and the appreciation of the equity of the company with all of the folks that worked in the company rather than what would normally happen in these privately held companies where 2, 3, maybe 5, max 10 persons would own all the stock in the company. So in this way, he empowered all of the employees to have a stake in the business. And when he retired from the company, we worked out a deal so that he took his YSI stock as the majority shareholder and put all that stock, essentially did a transaction with the ESOP, and all of that stock ultimately, of course, paid off to the employees when the business was sold in the fall of 2011. So one of the consequences of that is that all the folks in the business, all the employees that worked in the company were able to share in the appreciated value of the business over the years.
And a large endowment left to Antioch College, who have subsequently purchased the license to WISO.
That's correct. That's a very interesting story how that happened. Over the years, a lot of the stock was gifted through donations and through capital campaigns. So for example, I remember in the 90s when I was on the Board of Trustees and worked with the former president of Antioch University, Al Guskin. We were the beneficiaries of a lot of donations of stock as part of that capital campaign. And, of course, the stock at that time was illiquid. But ultimately, when we did the deal for the sale of YSI in September 2011, all of that investment was liquefied and it translated into about a $34 million gift to Antioch College.
After Hardy's retirement in 1985, you became president at YSI. Tell me a little bit about the condition he left that company in and how he worked.
Yeah, he left behind a treasure of great ideas and inventions and technology So YSI's legacy under Hardy's leadership was the gift of many different kinds of instruments and sensors. And what we did subsequently to that was figure out how to focus the company in particular markets, leveraging those inventions and that technology.
Final comments about the legacy of this man?
Yeah, I think that Hardy combined, interestingly enough, both a business that focused on great ideas, inventions, with social justice. So he institutionalized a lot of the ideas of Douglas MacGregor, who was the president of Antioch College in the late 40s, and through that process empowered individuals and teams of people to tinker, as he referred to it, and to push the frontier relative to new products and new technology. I think with the passing of Hardy Trolander, it's essentially the end of an era, because the giants who were graduates of the college or were attracted to Yellow Springs by Arthur Morgan and subsequent presidents of the college like Serge Vernet, Morris Bean, Hardy Trolander started businesses in the community benefited, hired employees, many of whom were graduates of the college. So the whole concept was this constellation of having a college, a community, and graduates of the college who became leaders in the community.
Malte von Matheson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I was happy to do this.
Maybe one day along the way you remember me on this island smiling at you.
You're listening to YSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Joining me in studio, Gabriella Pickett. She is the curator of Missing Piece Art Space in Dayton, and Judith Woolert Maldonado, Yellow Springs photographer and DJ. Ladies, welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
We are going to talk about the Dia de los Muertos Dayton event, the second year for this, but Dia de los Muertos actually has a long history. Tell us about that.
Dia de los Muertos is a tradition that predates the arrival of Columbus in America. It was supposed to be a tradition where the Aztecs would honor Mictlantecuhtli, who was the goddess of the underworld. And the Aztecs believed that on November 1st, the souls of the departed ones would come and visit us. And it was supposed to be a joyful celebration. If people would cry, they believed that the tears would make their pathway to our world and back to their world a little bit slippery, and they would have trouble coming back and forth. They would provide food and the music and all the items that the loved ones enjoyed when they were alive. And so it was more of a celebration of their life rather than, you know, remembering their departure.
Has this tradition evolved over time?
Yes. When the Spaniards came to America, it kind of became a syncretic tradition mixed with Catholicism. And so it kind of was integrated to the Old Saints Day. So there was this religion undertones. But now it has come to the United States, now we integrated what's a parade. And that's not really typical in Mexico. But I think it's a great addition to the tradition.
And also, this specific Dayton Dia de los Muertos celebration, we are focusing more on the Mexican tradition of Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead. But we are honoring Day of the Dead traditions all over the world, all over Latin America. And the celebrations are very different. And the Mexican celebration in particular tends to be a bit more colorful, a lot more colors, a lot more celebratory than, for example, where my family is from, Argentina, is very solemn and it's different.
So I wanted to ask about the first year that this celebration took place in Dayton. Can you talk a little bit about the response to last year's event?
Sure. It was an incredible community building event. We came to realize that celebrating the loved one is something that can unite all of us. You know, we can be very different, but when it comes to everybody remembering a loved one, we can find that, you know, we share a certain unity. And a lot of people express the desire to have this event on a yearly basis. And I think every year will become bigger, and it will also continue to transform itself. It'll become more of a community event. And we're also now thinking of the importance of this Mexican tradition in terms of healing. And we had some children who brought some altars for their grandparents, and it was a beautiful experience that they're sharing with us. And at the same time, you know, they're coming to terms with the fact that their grandparents passed away.
What is typically done, people make ofrendas or altars for Dia de los Muertos, and on those altars they can put photographs of a loved one who has passed away, flowers, food offerings, candles burning. And a lot of that is what we did last year, and there was community ofrenda or a community altar. And it was wonderful to see how members of the community who might never have heard of such a celebration, how they really came out and brought photographs of their loved ones. And it was such a wonderful cross-cultural learning experience for a lot of people.
Let's talk about some of the details of this event. There is an opening reception on Friday, November 1st.
We're asking the community to come out to the location of the Synergy Incubator's Creative Kitchen, which is Jefferson and Fifth Streets. And we ask folks to meet at about 5:15 p.m. on Friday, November 1st. And they can enjoy the wonderful food truck rally that is being organized by the Synergy Incubators. And that's where people will gather. We ask people to dress up, if they wish, as what we call the calavera, or the skull, is an important symbol imagery that's used, especially in the Mexican tradition of Dia de los Muertos. And this is indeed a family-friendly event, but families, children will find many people donning the skull as a costume item. And so we invite the public to indeed dress up with skulls, skeletons. It really is a part of celebrating the dead and the lives of our loved ones who we've lost. So we ask people to set up for the parade. And then from there, Michael Bashaw will be leading a group of percussive marchers, people who will be stomping the ground with these special bamboo sticks that he's created just for this event. And he'll be leading the parade all the way down to the Missing Piece Art Space. And from there, we'll continue the celebration. There will be an art exhibition that is all related to Dia de los Muertos. There will be community ofrendas, or altars, and we will have some food vendors there as well. And I will be DJing that evening as well at the end of the parade with some Latin dance tunes.
We're also going to have Orgullo Mexicano. It's a Mexican folkloric dance group. And we're going to have Alicia Pagan, a wonderful local artist, and she's going to be singing and calling our ancestors. So I think it's going to be, there's going to be something for everybody. It doesn't matter whether you're 2 years old or 90 years old. I don't think anybody will be scared or in shock. You know, if you can deal with Halloween, you can definitely deal with the Dia de los Muertos.
It sounds like a wonderful event. I've been speaking with Gabriela Pickett, curator of Missing Piece Art Space in Dayton, and Judith Woolert Maldonado, a Yellow Springs photographer and DJ. Ladies, thanks so much for telling us about this event.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. Muchas gracias.
Tomorrow night, the Little Art Theater in Yellow Springs will host a free screening of the documentary More Than a Month. The movie is about ending the annual celebration of Black History Month. Community Voices producer Basim Blunt spoke with John Gudgel, one of the organizers of tomorrow's presentation.
Welcome, John. We all know you as guidance counselor at Mills Lawn School and former principal at Yellow Springs High School. You're here today in the capacity of being the chairperson of the 365 Project. Can you tell us a little bit about the presentation at the Little Art tomorrow?
We're featuring the film called More Than a Month, and this is in recognition of the Elaine Comegys Film Festival that the 365 Project puts on every year.
Tell me about Elaine Comegys. Who is she and why is the festival named after her?
Elaine Comegys is a beloved member of the community, and she actually was a member of the Antioch College faculty, served in the co-op department, and she was later appointed as an associate dean of students here at Antioch. Following her death in 2007, the 365 Project said, why don't we do something to recognize Elaine? And we thought, what better thing to do than to have a film festival where you engage in courageous conversations about race?
And the film talks about ending Black History Month. And the filmmaker also brings into question there's no need for any ethnic heritage months. I think he challenges a Latino, Hispanic Heritage Month,
correct,
Asian Heritage Month.
Yes.
Why can't it all be just American history? And I think that's the provocative question about the movie.
And that's the question we want our students to think about, because as you look back to the civil rights struggle, where there was a big push to have Black History Month, in many ways, that's been lost. However, America has a feel-good moment every February with Black History Month. And I think we've heard many people say that now that we have a black president, there's no need to discuss issues of civil rights, racism, things of that nature, because we have a black president. That couldn't be further from the truth. And I think this film gets us to thinking once again about recognizing the aspects of diversity, African-American history, and the fact that it needs to be discussed every day of the year and not just one month. And I think it's very important for people in the audience to recognize that he poses the question, but we're responsible for answering and dialoguing. In addition to the Elaine Comegys Film Fest, you know, we're also very active and engaged in what's called our Elder Speak, where we brought in some of our elders who grew up in Yellow Springs in the 30s and 40s, and then we brought in another group of people who grew up in Yellow Springs in the 50s and 60s. And it was very enlightening because people have this feeling of Yellow Springs being a perfect utopia-type setting.
Right.
And it amazed me to listen to some of these elders talk about the racism that they grew up with and experienced in Yellow Springs. Even at our own little art theater, which was segregated, and if you're black, you sat in the back behind a rope. And there are a number of people who said, hey, we're not going to tolerate that anymore. And they forced the issue for the little art to integrate. And there were establishments in Yellow Springs, eateries, where blacks were not allowed to enter. Well, Yellow Springs had some drama in its past, too.
Just like the rest of America.
Yes,
you know, and
definitely.
I think it mirrors the struggle that was going on society-wide in the 50s and 60s. But it's a testimony to the people that live in this village that makes it such a cool place,
yes,
and so tolerant now.
Mm-hmm. I think what's happened is that many of the trailblazers in Yellow Springs who were very instrumental in the civil rights movement, not only locally but nationally, as they've gotten up in age, it falls upon us, our contemporaries, to take the mantle and run with it.
The film takes place tomorrow, Monday, October 28th at 7 p.m. at the Little Art Theater. It's a digital screen, so the projection is great, digital sound. Any final thoughts, John, that you want to share about tomorrow night?
Well, I want to emphasize that it's free, and you need to come early because there have been past years where we've had to turn people away because we have so many people who come to this event. Look forward to seeing everybody there.
Tomorrow at 7 p.m., the Elaine Comegys Black Film Festival presentation of More Than a Month. After the film, there's going to be a post-screening discussion.
Thank you for stopping by the studio.
Thank you.
For Why So Weekend, this has been Community Voices producer Basim Blunt.
I'm Jerry Kenney. This is Why So Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. We wrap up this month's series of faculty readings from the Antioch Writers Workshop with Kathy Essinger. She's the author of three books of poetry, and her work has been featured on The Writer's Almanac and Conrad's Corner on WYSO.
I'm going to read a poem about my black cat. What the black cat is not. The black cat at the end of the hall resembles everything that she is not. She is the word you cannot recall, the phrase that cannot be taught. A piece of the night, nearly opaque, a paradox of forgetfulness when memory replaces heartache. She is spearmint, licorice, and anise, cardamom on the back of the tongue, a wish, a secret, the thread of doubt that lingers when daylight has clung to the bleary edge of sleep without the comfort of reason, or the tender bruise of longing we do not discuss. She is a mirror over blackened water, the plushness of midnight, a crevice. The stories that you tell in a whisper, the things that you know by heart. She is everything dark and familiar, everything present that dwells apart. I like animals. I write about them a lot. And I think I figured out writing poetry that what I like about animals is the kind of person that I am when I'm around an animal. I went to a workshop one time where a very well-known poet, whose name will remain anonymous, told me, don't ever, ever, ever personify animals unless you want to work for Walt Disney. And right then and there, I decided that I was going to write a lot of poems about animals. Title of this poem is My Dog Practices Geometry, and it kind of refers to that moment. I do not understand the poets who tell me that I should not personify. Every morning, the willow auditions for a new role outside my bedroom window. Today, she is Clytemnestra. Yesterday, a southern belle, lost in her own melodrama, sinking on her skirts. Nor do I like the mathematicians who tell me I cannot say the zinnias are counting on their fingers or the dog is practicing her geometry. Even though every day I watch her using the yard's big maple as the apex of a triangle from which she bisects the circumference of the lawn until she finds the place where the rabbit has escaped or the squirrel has upped the ante by climbing into a new Euclidean plane. She stumbles across the lawn, eyes pulling her feet along, gaze fixed on a rodent working the maze of the oak as if it were his own invention, her feet tangling in the roots of trees and, yes, tripping even over themselves until I go out to assist by pointing at the squirrel and repeating, there, there. But instead of following my outstretched arm to the crown of the tree where the animal is now lounging under a canopy of leaves, catching its breath, charting its next escape, she looks to my mouth, eager to read my lips, confident that I, who can bring her home from across the field with a word, who can speak for the willow and the zinnia, can surely charm a squirrel down from a tree.
Kathy Essinger reading her poems in the Antioch Writers Workshop. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.